Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about failure. Sounds an awful word, but this podcast is going to be about trying to look into the experience, psychology, and value of failure. Now, one of the things is that it seems to be rather a label that successful people can shun off, say, look, I'm definitely not a failure. And when you dig underneath the surface, when you discover people who, there are some genuinely successful people, but there are still some mock successful people who actually deal and amplify failure around them. And often gets everyone thinking about the term of failure. So I'd just like to talk about it, because it's such a, I think, an interesting thing that you have this area where there seems to be a lot of failure about the place, and people who sort of say, yep, okay, let's look at failure, seem to be successful in a different way, in a longer term, more genuine term, rather than the people who get sort of declarative or I just want social success. Now, this is going to sound complicated, so, and it is indeed a group of thoughts not fully formed, and hopefully they'll form as we go throughout the place. Now, there is a sort of a beautiful mathematics of probability, and sort of working out the statistical significance of something. So that's perhaps more often than not that a situation will not either be a success or a failure, but will contain information. And the value of that information is really associated with significance. So there's a sort of a whole galaxy or a whole midden of experience which you can go through, neither success or failure, and you can extract the significance of it. So that's, I'm just trying to get into the mathematics of it. Also, there is sort of a standpoint of manipulating probabilities. There's Bayes' theorem, and it gets really quite complicated to add up success or the probability of this happening and that happening, but the probability of it not happening is something that you can actually add up a bit more easily. It's something that I will have to relearn and re-get into, and that's probabilistic maths. It's sort of, I suppose, interesting just looking completely abstractly that there's all situations which have information in it, and the information can be perceived as patterns, and those patterns themselves translate into significance. So it's a slightly more structured, complex view of looking at a situation. I suppose it's an idea of, in a situation, can I extract money out of it? Can I extract food? Can I extract influence from it? But you can also extract information from it. But the information has to go through several processes before it's actually got intellectual value. Now, that's neither success or failure. So if something costs more than to produce than you get from it, that's I suppose technically a failure, or your influence goes down, that's a failure. It's just the interaction of minds as you look at something. So people who are not schooled in, I suppose, probability and mathematics will come very much schooled in the culture of success and believe that there is a certain quantity of stuff, certain quantity of success available, and you've got to go out there and you have to subtly make sure that you get more of it than the other people, and there has to be a justification for you getting more of it than other people by you being more worthy of it, and therefore you have to go out and control the worthiness parameters. Those things are rather a complicated process. They're off working out who should win, how they should win, and the actual cultural framework doing it. So say if you've got a set of information, you've got this whole series of activities which are not productive associated with it, determining success and failure. And of course, the success of the people who can dominate the probably call it a pseudo-intellectual process. They come up with the conclusion that they win, and therefore can take, the winner takes all, and essentially it's sort of pseudo-intellectual robbery that comes across, and the entire issue is it's not necessarily about winning and losing in every situation, it's about extracting the maximum value of information. Now this sounds stupid, but I think when you sum up what the human race is doing, that's essentially, if you look at all the technologies, houses, chemicals, lights, all the technology about ourselves, that technology, yes, it's got a winning and losing story with it, but it's the general thrust of technology, human knowledge, is the ability to attach deeper significance to patterns and things, i.e. to observe a pattern of geology, to work out where coal is, to work out what to do with coal, and build upon the significance of it. What we have now is this something which is at the other end of the spectrum. I'll see if I can really try and spell it out. It's a bit complicated to try and get it communicated across. And this is where I see a real difference. So at one end of the spectrum we've got the winners and losers. Sorry, I just had to break there as I was about to sneeze. I don't know if you can hear it, but I'm on a long-term gentle cardiac walk. It's one of my very first walks that I went on. Very long, hard, slow gradient walk. So I should be able to do it quite well. But the key thing that I suppose as a research scientist, you have this nuanced relationship with information. You know, fundamentally, you know, that's, and it's sort of like a direct relationship with information. And it's not necessarily that the information's good or bad. It's significant. And, when you're from that regime and you're thrown into another regime where there's winners and losers and, the results are hard to access, and information, the flow of information is different, you sort of say, hang on, if I step back from the emotional and the, you know, what's going to happen here, and actually look at it, there's a fundamental core difference or relationship with information. And it is almost as if the actual processing of information is put aside, that's too hard, and we're going to deal with the significance of the information, and that significance has these two factors, the winners and losers, the successes and failures. So you can actually have a group of information, and the result can be that the group that you don't want, the people you don't want, fail. And in that process, in that step of process, you have to really skip over the analysis, because often the data can point many different ways and the interpretation is quite sophisticated and you have to go deeply into it, and the significance is not easy. And is that sort of technical processing, and you have to push that aside, you have to put walls up against it. And so initially when you're looking at the situation, you're saying, strange, I can't, some reason, political or some social reason, I don't know what it is, it's not being told to me, I can't conduct investigations or conduct logic from that. And really it's almost like research folding in on itself to actually look at this non-research area, so that research is developed sufficiently that you can look at it. So what I wanted to do in this podcast is this really fairly complicated story about where you actually talk about failure. It's not failure as, oh my god, I've got to get rid of it, but it is very interesting in that there are certain things that you can say or do or exist, and the sort of social contacts wind down dramatically everywhere you look. And this you can sort of interpret in terms of as this grief and terror and all the things that are in the language of failure. Or you can look at it and you can say, what are the critical features of the situation which translate from an orchestrated thing where you don't have access to information or information doesn't flow in the correct way? You know, this is, rather than sort of saying, I want information to grow, if I can get more power, personal power, or diminish, solve the power equation, social power equation, could the information fly? So you can suck into that direction, but in general, there is this other way of looking at information and significance, and it's really interesting in that people who haven't really understood the way of the researcher teach it in a particular hypothesis, in a particular deductive way, it's really hard to describe. When you look at the way things are taught, there's this way of processing information in which the process of information results in a social outcome, and you have to present it in a particular way such that it fits the model of a social transaction. Whereas information is a lot more subtle and it's got a lot more information inside it. And the concept of information having many layers of stories, many layers of complexity in it, ready to communicate with you beyond what an author has put into it, is a fundamental topic. It's a fundamental thing of the practice of statistics and the practice of Bayesian analysis. Eventually, eventually ethics. This like ethics is really second rate if you say, well, it's ethical if I have Americans and policemen and army soldiers and all the powerful people which I've ticked off, and I've made great efforts to make sure that they're not corrupt. That's sort of a very low grade ethics to a more inductive ethics, i.e. that is, you look at the different situations and you run different grades of simulation through it to work out what's the best way to do it. It's this fundamental relationship with information which you have to get to. Now, and I've sort of, on deep reflection, worked out, look, this area of approach is like a two-level thing of approach, which I'll call the bad failure-oriented thing, and the information collected has a consequence. Now, this is the entire thing of school and HSC and assessment of people, whereas, you know, people as productive units, they produce so much, bring in so much money for the company or do things at a certain level, they're good and we can use that information, and you really have to be committed and worry about that information to translate that into behaviour. So it's sort of like a whole package deal of success and failure, and your sensitivities to success and failure going into controlling behaviour. Therefore, you can, basically trap people, you know, and ensure that you educate other people to be equally sensitive to success and failure, which is all very well, but at eventually point this becomes an end in itself, and from the outside observer you can actually look at the methodology people are using and pick up statistical flaws. Now, it's a huge dislocation, so I can see statistical flaws in the execution of people's worldview, and I don't know how to describe it. There's I'll have to get up a basic probability diagram, or the way that you do probability, because people are so success oriented, it's a very difficult. That is not the way necessary to do probability. It's one minus it. There's still two aspects to statistical analysis. There's many aspects. One is the Bayes theorem, or also understanding the cost of information, or if you gather so much information, you can lead yourself down a particular track of reasoning, and you can lead yourself down a track of reasoning and not be able to reason your way out of it, unless you have the appropriate tools. And it is actually, I know this sounds strange, there is a toolkit that you can sort of ask. So if you're in a situation, and I've seen in a few, industrial accidents, horrible, horrible things. And the methodology of people coming in really does not, like they have three explanations that they pick the most likely. Then given that as their founding explanation, they then go down and they all pick like one or two or three possible outcomes. And so there's so that's a failure. That's an analysis of failure, to restructure it in a success model. So failure is a big problem for a success model people. They have to characterize it in a way that doesn't cause the stress to their success model, which is very much different. So the amount of tools they bring to something is very much different from what you'd expect. And there's, I'm not a guru, but there's a few things that you can ask or say at a situation, and you really have to do it fairly soon after a situation, is saying, how did we get here? What is the processes that we get here? And that allows it, sort of, it's a from the failure upwards analysis, allows you to ask significantly different questions. Now, I must say, in my mind along here, is that there was a dreadful accident where this lab assistant fell over, broke a bottle of concentrated sulfuric acid and fell over into it. And I was involved. Well, I hosed it down, took action, took control. There's sort of nothing much to it in terms of that's fairly standard, I suppose, military training. Like, week in, week out, you'd have, the warrant officer say, so-and-so's happened, fix it. And you'd take over and call the radio. And for being a SIG, I called in the ambulance and fire brigade to clean up everything and got it all under control. But afterwards, it was very interesting in that one of the outcomes that the employer wanted to do is they wanted to get rid of this person because it was inconvenient of its success. And the entire way of analysing it was failure adverse. Obviously it had been a failure, but it had to be, failure had to be found in such a way there was no other failures in the situation. So it's actually quite a bit frightening after a while, that once this process, sort of slightly fake process, had come into looking after this, the accident, fixing it all up, it then went on this sort of awful next process. This poor person who had given up so much, suffered so much, finally had the final indignity of it. And of course, this has not got a healthy view. It pushes the people around inside into what I call active bystanders. So you want to make sure that everyone in there are well-trained bystanders. And that's pretty much sort of explains what I saw. The people there, the person had the accident, people weren't necessarily helping, didn't know what to do, because they'd been so much pushed into this bystander view. And why you, so that's a consequence of this, your relationship with information being a social relationship, and your goal is not to develop the information more in such that you expand your social position. Now, if everyone plays that, that's the only game in town. It can actually seal up all the resources, ensure that that is the only game in town. And essentially, in a group of people like this, you can see someone who's been productive outside the system, and they'll start putting up barriers, so they're physical barriers, but also information barriers, so you don't ask certain types of questions, which, I don't know, being able to ask sufficient bank of questions, you start to find out ones which are really useful. And in general, the most useful open question is, well, how did we get, what are the factors which led to us getting here? And that's not a standard, thing that we do. People running the shop, tend to call meetings and they say, well, here's the agenda, I've said it, that's it, and we're going to try and push this, meeting or review such that we get the intended outcome to fit. It's sort of like pre-thinking, or I suppose it's pre-thinking and pre-going on. It's sort of like going ahead of prejudice, and it's like I'm at this horrible stage, I think, where I've developed ideas, developed maths and software in actual fact, to hold things together, present things, and it's going through a process where people, you know, the tide is going out, there's very little support for it. However, this is the entire thing about research and being able to ask deeper questions, is that you don't need that social support to function, to think the next thought. So a lot of people need their job, position, accolade, affirmation every step of the way. And when that goes right, and when they are sort of programmed to be sensitive to it, when people are beginning to move beyond it, you see this retraction. And that's very much the language of success and failure. We feel that you are going into a failure regime, so we're pulling back from you. And that's not so much a statement about you, it's a statement about their needs. It's sort of an interesting aspect to it. So I just want to talk a little bit about probability theory. Now, the interesting thing is, at the end of the day, if you don't do maths and you don't understand statistics, you can't understand directly things. And so information comes to you, and sometimes the information has been doctored to you, and there's quite a lot of the times I look through information, you just automatically pick things up. So one of the more standard things is when you get a document is you look at the metadata, look when it was authored, and is it at all consistent with policy or anything else like that? And sometimes it's not, so you can't even process it there. Or then, if you're looking at a role or bulk statistics, you look for what is the number. The number between groups. So in very simple terms, in a group of 200 students, on average, you'll get 3 anaphylactics, 3 of this 5 learning difficulties per year, and the variation, the standard deviation of that is about 3 or 4. And then occasionally when you come across to the next group of information where there's none, there's an obvious information. That's one sort of thing about the information-to-information quality, which you can pick up. Now, the interesting thing is that a conversation that you have back and saying, well, look, this is saying this, and this would indicate that. Because the information doesn't speak to them, they have no alternative but to believe that you are saying it rather than the information is saying it. So that's an important thing to go through. But looking at that's one example. So you've got school group lists, and you can see statistically, going from one to the other, that certain groups are not doing it. And it's not rocket science. If there is one group which has got no anaphylactic kids, and if that is indeed true, you can actually say, oh, well, this is worth investigating. Or alternatively, you can just go from classroom to classroom and have a quick poll and actually get the physical number that haven't been picked up. But of course, once you've done that, the more important thing is to actually understand how the information is being managed. And it's only after a long while where I've got extreme views of this happening systematically that I can pick things up. But there are many other things. One is to look down a group of marks or something like that. And there's something called Bickford's theorem, which sort of says that it's the frequency of particular marks or numbers with respect to whether they're randomly generated or generated by some sort of social system. And you can basically look down a series of marks or numbers, and very quickly, just by counting without looking at the number of eights, number of sixes, you know, there's more even than odd numbers used in it, you can see whether they're contrived or actual numbers. Or, that's one aspect of it, and I got myself really stuck up when I was doing my MBA, the first management stuff. They gave me charts, and I said, oh, well, what can you tell me? I can say, well, I can tell you that these numbers are made up. And of course, they didn't understand, because they had made them up. That was the idea, but I obviously didn't. It took me a while in the management. Only towards the end did I understand that marketing is purely about spin and psychology. And I just really didn't understand. I came across to my MBA from a PhD in quantum physics. Came across, I could not comprehend it. And so, there you go. And, to probably years after the MBA course, it slowly sink in the various aspects of it. And I suppose that was interesting to me because an MBA course is, you do this and at the end of that course you are fully qualified. Now I was qualified in certain areas, but didn't fully understand, fully professional. However, people who had really no understanding had a self-delusion. Now, I think if you can go back to Voltaire, my friend and my person, so I'm just booting up with this, trying to memorize things. As I speak, I go back through areas that I've learnt and saying, oh, I'm going to have to do that one again. Oh, I'm going to have to study this again. But going back to Voltaire, person, he said this beautiful thing. He said that it's not so much love is blind, but self-love is blind. And it's a really deep theme. And I actually don't feel sort of look down on people who have got this healthy, or not healthy, but this great complex of self-love. And it's because if you've got a lot of self-love or self-obsession, you tend to relate to people and understand to people in terms of supporting this self-love or success-failure model. And you tend to hear and understand and form relationships which feed the need for this self-love. This, I mean, this sounds, well, one of the things that one of the things that is really obvious now is that we have these things collecting huge amounts of data, and the data starts to tell you things. Like for me, looking at say a detector, I'll look at it and look at the signal out, look at the noise, and start playing around trying to eliminate the noise for it. Whereas people with a lower declarative understanding that this is a light detector, there can't be noise associated with it. And I'll just give a quick story about a Keithley electrometer detector. It's all very relevant because I've got a long walk going through here. Yeah, and this is sort of one of the mysteries for you. And look, this is a story that I've learnt from equipment. People learn from, you know, big experiences with other people, sort of going out camping with them. This is a piece of life experience I've learnt from. She was run over here. I can see a car coming. I have to walk off to the side. This is a pass. There's a sort of a valley system down from the mountain escarpment down, and there's this one road, and there's yahoos go along it. But it's all okay. Yeah, getting back to it. The Keithley electrometer. So the Keithley electrometer can measure basically currents, picoamps. These are thousands of electrons. This is not a thousand amp, not a milliamp, but a good fraction of a billionth of an amp. And you use it in various things, basically where you've got a pretty crappy light source. So this is in the world of the real world, where you don't have lasers all the time for everything. You've just got light sources, and they're thousands of times lighter and easier to run, all that stuff. It's much cheaper. Keithley source. So Keithley source is this beautiful, beautiful box with a needle on the front and these connectors on the front, these coaxial connectors, and they take a lot. And so really the first thing I detected was that they had a zero error if you had at all a slightly dirty connector. So you had to basically get these connectors and ultrasonically scrub them. So if you put something in an ultrasonic bath and turn up the volume of the actual solvent actually mechanically grates away the surface. That's really the only way you can really clean inside these nooks and crannies. And so that was one way. And then I could see two Keithleys. One had very poor noise. It would be saying that there's 600, no, there's 1,200 electrons per second going out of this device and go back up and down, up and down. And what would happen is that you could actually get it to read anything you want, but just by grabbing the coaxial and bending it. And of course, that would bending the cable, great insulation, but there's a piezoelectric effect, and so you can get these very small currents. So if you shake a cable or anything like that, and this then just, and I still don't know why. So this is sort of strange, like people declarative knowledge. So and so has got such and such a mark. I know that person's no good, and the person I do like anyway is good. And if you ask them, that they operate like this. So I had two Keithley electrometers, and I got a length of cable, noted that the noise is less in a longer cable. So there's supposed to be some sort of frequency resonance up and down the cable. I possibly think now. I've never understood it. And so, much to people's eye, I got about 10, 20 meters of coax. Absolutely dead. Dead die. Like this, it just was like this most remarkable feature. And it, went in and gave the measurement. Now, the thing is that I didn't have the full direct systematic knowledge of what caused what and how, but I had an overall view, a strategy of increasing the quality of the information, which is different from the success and failure criteria, and it's that statistical thing. Now, point that you want to do is that you want to get down and eliminate prejudice or eliminate random variations. And there's a series of people studying it will know at I think in psychology they call it the P factor. You know, the statistical significance of it. But, there's sort of like orders upon orders, and it's just a beautiful topic to study. And this is statistical significance, which is different from management significance, which I put into it. And people can't see that they take a series of steps. They walk in ignorance and wind up on an ignorance isn't that obviously they can't move from it because they've already committed themselves for it. So what I want to talk about is I've got a fair while to walk on this walk, but two statistical techniques. One is student study technique, and you're looking at the randomness of information that you're getting in. And truly, if you have done the things correctly, the fluctuations left over should be random. After that, you can detect causality from that. And it's not, you'll know the causality, you'll detect it. Sort of like the Keithley electrometer. I didn't know why it worked, but I knew that there was effect and that it could be found and that there was things that you could practically do. Now, that might have been a different cable that you could use. A whole lot of different things, things to use. And this is a type of thing if you're involved in radar. It's a bloody hard thing to do some of the time. Lots of energy going down these little, you're surprised. You've got a cable and you don't realize that you can cook something at the other end if you've got a few kilowatt of power. Sort of strange in terms of, came across there. So you've got students too. There's another thing called simplex algebra. Now, I don't know. There's two aspects to it. So if you can imagine a vast tour group of people with basically brochures on how to live life, and brochure, this piece of technology you have was built by so-and-so, so there's no actual understanding of it. And you have, so within that world, it's actually quite hostile, quite hard to operate within that world. coming out to it, you actually find these statistical techniques. When you study them, you don't, you've got no driving force saying, aha, that's going to help me do this better. It's just that it's sitting there, and when you come across it, there's this sort of gentle quietness to say, oh, I might try that. And you have to actually switch off. Because you can actually get some quite abusive people saying, where's this in time? And there's been a couple of times where I've enjoyed the trust that people said, he will get there the fastest of anybody by pushing. Not that I'm in that thing of, I wasn't using that as credit to do it. It was just this oneness in the lab to going through. So, what I wanted to point out is that, there's this random thing where you go through and pick up random bits, and then the statistic of the the likelihood that you could have actually studied the correct things to get that conclusion is impossibly low. Now, the most recent story I have is that going through the library, I recently picked up a book on platypus, and what's it going to be? And that was such a fantastic book. It sort of linked in with mammals, biology, theory of science, all moving up, and it was structured in a way, and it was, gave an x-ray into other sections of Australian society which operate outside the, I suppose you call it first order, knowledge handles. Actually, don't handle the knowledge itself. You handle the social significance of it and play around with the social significance. So this was at so many things, but the probability of me picking that particular book was extremely, low. I went back. Went through, and there was really no other book, nothing vaguely comparable to it. And there has been cases where I will just go through a library and pick a book, and it will be open the journal, and it will be at this incredibly important salient articles. And that's happened too many times for my comfort. And this is also true for Simplex Algebra. I just sort of drifted in to had a friend, they didn't understand it, I went into their course on just sat through a few lessons on Simplex Algebra, and that was such a wake-up call. So let's talk about Simplex Algebra. So this is right down the direction along from the failure-success regime, and I think I do have a critique of that regime, but let me talk to you about Simplex Algebra. So, what happened is that during World War II, the US Army, the US Navy, in the Pacific, amassed something so large that one couldn't comprehend it. They were producing 3 ships a day. The Germans couldn't manufacture enough torpedoes to blow out the German ships. They were amassing 1 million proximity shells a day. Oh, not a day. The battle that they had developed technology, landing technology for their planes, anti-aircraft stuff, a superior fire control, everything amassed so big. It was really the peak of a civilization, the US operating there. They went to designs. You look at what they did. They just rolled out. They were just, So I'm walking down this, it's not a canyon, but it's really a creek. And up above, you can hear the something moving. It's probably a wallaby. Okay, so the Americans developed this, and they had sort of just this fantastic system. And they, rather than gather, they had some precise information, but they had this wash of imprecise information. So they knew that in a particular area, that they had 5% casualties here with a certainty of plus or minus 3%. And another coordinate, they had something else associated. And for the particular type of information, they could display the information using matrix algebra. And they had a series of boundary conditions. They knew they had 3 days supply of food here, or it could be four, it could be six, you know, in this area, and they had to make decisions for it. And so for this, getting the information and plotting it onto a graph, onto a space where the information is fuzzy and it's not good. Now, so all these systems come available to you and you use it. So I'll have to go back. One of the things, I'll go back and restudy simplex algebra. I don't know if anyone uses it anymore. And it's all these, things, like I'm going back and doing Fourier analysis. Look, there's so many, so much, well, Fourier analysis, for instance, is information processing. We are living in an information processing age. Now, you may be able to shoot and knock out all your friends so that you have no one, you know no one who knows information analysis. There's a lot of people who say that, look, you're the only person that speaks like that. Go away. And what they're really doing is they're not sending you away, they're isolating themselves, unfortunately. Because at the end of the day, the maths speaks, the Keithley obeys, the lasers switch on, the instruments, the robots swing into action. Based on mathematics, based on a relationship with data and information which is sympathetic to the level that it was created at. It's a pretty amazing thing. And the ability, and it's very interesting in terms of, you know, what are CEOs, What are press releases? What's all this going on? And how does it operate? What is the role of the CEO? A lot of the times the CEOs have very poor understanding, poor mathematical abilities. What the heck is that? Oh, that's a possum up over here. So I'm now crossing Lennox Bridge. The main power of this is, I'm going downhill, it's a slope. It's going uphill. Afterwards, it's going to be a real breaker to it. So this is why I've sort of set off on this, not deep discussion, but really trying to get into, this binary thing. I suppose I'm at the point of, recognizing that not the quality of information, but the quality of information processing is a significant thing, and it's not something necessary for debate, because given a pile of data, you can draw a series of things. You can draw out first level significance, and you can draw the potentiality of the significance. And that entire methodology of thinking is actually not being taught. And I'm very much aware of it from actually structuring things such that it can be taught. And the sort of lack of genuine lack of sort of anger and lack of understanding. So let's, at this point, I've mentioned simplex algebra, and I've used it in simplex algebra in a lot of type situations, or even the methodology of simplex algebra. So various people will, and it sort of flips over. It's one of those sort of ridiculous things. So certain people will claim, we're doing this, and it's done 100 times. You take the 100 times, it must, hundreds of times, so it must be, X must be greater than 200. At least, okay. Then you break that in and work out where the data is likely to be. Then you inquire, where is it? And you realize that it's not there. And then, you come back and people say, well, I never said there was 200, which is sort of what you, it's sort of like this reflection. So in the American wartime situation, people gave their direct information deliberately. I'm in a situation where I've got the Japanese and the Americans putting in information to get up. But if I can just say what a joy simplex algebra is, in terms of its, I don't know, I think it's outside quantum mechanics. And should I dare say, quantum mechanics is this thing where the actual unit of particle, the bip, is actually a mathematical function. It's a wave function. And what people haven't done is they haven't asked, they haven't been sat with and said, describe what you think a point is. Okay, well, using those categories, here's what a wave function is. They haven't actually been pulled across there. Simply because, and you ask the reason why this isn't so. Well, the dominating paradigm is that information is success, failure, and success and failure is a social thing associated with the learner. So that learner will not move. You can actually give them a piece of information, and success and failure lock them into place. So I can see this sort of quantum mechanics locking them up, and that people looking at these things find it hard to actually comprehend. Can I say it's a full moon, and it's beautiful, and I'm walking down this Mitchell's Pass, and it is a glorious, glorious view from the intimacy of the Blue Mountains, which is, there's no lights, you can just see things occasionally, you can hear the odd wallaby up the top, and the old possum going around the place, and you walk around, and just the valley opens up, and you can see, stretching to the horizon, urban sprawl lights. I suppose it's a bit, and of course, you'll hear a car racing down to the side. And of course, when I was first doing this walk, it's a beautifully serenely quiet. For some reason, the weather, the temperatures are stuff, and the city is completely silent. You can hear the odd car. Oh, this car coming behind me. Yep, we just wait. This has come past. You have to be on your best behaviour there. So, it's rather cute. As I was doing this at night, the police would do their patrol and just do a couple of patrols to see how I was doing. This is when I was first had a cardiac thing, a little jumper on myself, and eventually, a brightly coloured, I wanted a brightly coloured reflective jacket. But I think, look, I'm safe here. In the morning, if you do this in the early morning, it's a fantastic walk, but it's absolutely mad. All these cars are using this as a short dip back down to the factories in New Plains. So New Plains is a big factory place. But we're getting back to the point of success, failure, mathematics, and looking at what you call metadata, or the actual maximum amount of information that can be extracted from some information. And there's this thing of actually the nature of your question relates to the nature of just getting out of here. It's not like coming down at the nature of your assumptions. How can I put it down? The entire aspects of, I suppose, inductive reasoning, that's not on at all. So, you're looking at the quality of the information coming in. You're saying, well, what can I deduce from it? What is its value in inductive reasoning? It's this, what can I further see downstream from it? What could I add to it to see upstream from the logic of it? This sort of understanding of that we're so far behind in teaching reasoning, it's not funny. So we teach a deductive reasoning and give it a bit of an inductive spill, but keep it really deductive the entire time. And so this comes to my formulation of teaching science experiments. And it goes along this path. I may as well go through it. And you can see how it comes across to the success-failure criteria. Like the worst case is you have a name, then you have a hypothesis, and then you have the hypothesis is either proved or disproved, but the hypothesis has to be a reasoned one, i.e. hypothesis has to be rooted in deductive reasoning, which sort of leads it again, but the end result is it's got two levels of social outcome. It's got social outcome of the hypothesis itself, and another level of how will you do the whole process, whether you give a tick or flick to it. So that's the extreme end. On the other end, we have this process, which I've basically, due to my shoddy memory, put into a system. Firstly, is you're walking along, and something hits you. You ask a question. Then you go, tell me more, mate. Tell me more. So you go to this process, and you go, preamble. You know, I'm walking along, and this is my question. It's like, well, I don't know if you can hear that, or I can hear it. That's a bloody New Guinea Channel bill. There's a cuckoo, and it comes down here. The birds hate these cuckoo birds. I don't know why they come down here in summer, and look, they can keep you up at night. Say if you're camping out at night. We used to have one in our house, and so it got these little birds, and the cuckoo grows up to the size of a big chicken, and they're not that bright, and this one fell in a barbecue area, and its corpse stunk. Like anything, it was, oh, what that? And there's this dead channel will stop there. It can go on for hours. It's stopped. They'll stop there. So let's get back into it. Your question, your preamble, saying, linking that question, giving a bit more structure to it. The reason that you do that is that if you're at the question, the preamble's a little bit easier, whereas a certain preamble, your freer listener can say, well, I've got these three questions, and they're not going to be really listening to your question. Then you just state a pattern. Now, you may have wisdom on a pattern, but you're not sure. You just say, look, I think this will happen. Then you set a path to take a picture or an image or model the pattern. So that's a path, and that's a path that you're taking, you're planning ahead for one aspect. It's also a path that someone can check that you've actually gone off in the right direction to take a pattern, to take a picture. And let's go on to it. So the path is your method. The picture, your pattern, is the hypothesis. So a hypothesis is a guess. I guess a structural guess that such and such will happen. And when I say pattern, this is from two aspects. One is from pattern recognition in quantum physics and in gravity waves and in particle physics. They are looking for a particular pattern, and it's got a very high noise signal, but we want to see whether that pattern is there. So the pattern is a structure of nature which is intelligible, and that's different from data. It's got the word, a pattern is something in nature which I can intelligate. I can apply significance to it. We'll get onto significance a bit later. So you've got your preamble, pattern, path, and picture. So your picture may be a graph, maybe some data, maybe actually a physical picture. It could actually be a working model or something. It's something which is a pattern. The working model displays equivalence to something else. And then we go through the process now of significance. Now, this is very different from value of significance. Significance is that we often talk about is it evidentially significant, and that is it valid. Now the problem with using the word valid is it's just got a risk of validity being to, in quotes, are you stupid? Yeah. Are you so dumb as a, are you in grade 7, year 7? Have you not really understood all these sorts of things? It's, I think the evidential significance is something which has come out of, I read Gravity Wave Social Results, a beautiful thick book called Gravity's Kiss, I think it was. Yeah, Gravity's Kiss, a beautiful thick book. I don't think anyone's going to read it again because Gravity Waves stuff's sort of come along. But one would say that it's one of these things that someone in the classroom will talk about validity because that's the way they've been taught it. And scientists coming back will say, how do I speak? It's like translating to people back in the way, and they'll talk about validity and all this aspect of it. But ultimately, when they get out of the field, a long distance away from snarly people who are doing social significance, they'll say, what is the evidential significance of this? What is the validity of it? And then the next thing, so this is why evidential significance is, I think, a better word than validity, because it's got more nuance. Something can be valid or invalid, or it's valid or it's not. It's on or off. And so that's not what the way science operates. I'm now walking under these high voltage cables, and they're just making a pretty god awful buzz. It must have been slightly moist, and a bit of dust and all that type of stuff. Again, you probably can't hear it. Yeah, and then we have reliability. Now, reliability is actually charged with personal thing. Oh yeah, you're a reliable engine, or you're a reliable person. Your value is your honesty, and your reliability is whether I can trust you. It's got all these social things I'd love to move away from. And people sort of put it into their science teaching, and then before long it's not too much of a step for them to step in with people saying, look, I don't know. So we've got numerical significance, and then, which you can sort of see for me in terms of looking down a set of data that student data is not, there's numerically significance, it's got a lack of reliability, and therefore not mentioning that it's not reliable is a sort of, there's negligence in association with the way that you speak with. Obviously, it's the real issues is the two cultures just not intersecting, and the response of one is the two cultures don't intersect. But if you don't know there's a second culture, it is, you know, get rid of this person. Now it's. Gee, they come down here it's pretty fast. Now what often happens is that you've got another car traveling quickly behind it. I'll go in this walk. That's going to be a tough, I'm still going downhill. So that gives you an idea. Now, there is another significance, personal, social significance. Now, this is something which is sort of, this is something which, having moved away, this is obviously a question that could be asked. Why can't it be asked? You can really, you're open to ask any type of question you like about your data. This is just suggested areas. But social significance maybe is the data new to you. And you have to actually do it. Otherwise, if you have this view that knowledge is there and it's known, there's something a bit more to looking at stuff. You've got to work it until you understand it. There's no point. It's not a criticism, but there's a lot of things that people. There's some people. It really reminds me of a pretty shonky person who I had a book my wife was throwing out called Australian Intellectual Property. Had a look at it before I threw it out, thought I'd have a little read through it. Out of date, chuck it out. This professor came in and said, oh, can I have it? And he put the book in the back of his shelf. So he had read it, and it was sort of this significance. He was communicating the significance that he knew this data already, and this has got to be this humbleness, practicality. Like you really can't know something until you can model it and computer program it. Is my basic things, and it's not these groups of people, and it's really rather sad to see it is students who are a bit like Einstein, saying like clever hands, this horse, that they can replicate things on command, but do they actually have they learnt to assimilate and self-test, self-assemble knowledge? And so Einstein had this long way that he left a lot of maths for, and he didn't understand, not necessarily understand a lot of deeper maths, and he would work out what is physically possible, and then he'd leave it for the clever hands to do. And this is the where you should ask: is this information new to me? Is it new to society? How will it go? Why not discuss that? Now, you can't discuss that in the earlier form, which is results, conclusion, discussions. You could, but really, that's the province of the teacher. He says, I've decided that you've understood this. Tick. Move on. And this is sort of the real danger of where people operate as priests, so to speak, rather than just consultants, so to speak. When I say priests, you know, priests give you a sacrament. They do a hocus pocus, boom, bang. I give you some grace. You're okay. The people who you don't like, who aren't attending this service, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, yep, you have permission, my permission, not to think. In fact, a lot of teachers would be my criticism of them, is that they give such awful gifts. They give to students who can the permission not to think. The students who can't, a feeling that they'll never be able to achieve it. And then they achieve the social outcome that that gels people's understanding. But coming through here, at this next stage, after that, I have a multiple choice question, which is a way of distilling review. Now, why would you want to do a review after you've done the experiment? Because the process of experiments, you have self-taught. You have taught yourself stuff, and you point to review. And there are things that you may have thought, but you do now no longer thought. So I really think this question is review. And then once you have reviewed, you can therefore succinctly put the answer in a way which is really significant. So it's got the answer of the pattern and the picture. Yes, it seems to be a very superficial thing to say. Yes, the pattern, the picture is like the pattern I predicted, but it's got all these nuances, these things where you can extract a heap more information. In fact, this is the entire thing, is this thing about, oh, this is really pushing me, guys. It's asking the significance of the data. What is the significance of everything you've taught me, or the entire process, or what, you know, let's say, what is the significance of greater analysis of this as opposed to lower analysis of it? That is that I have some data in front of me, and that data will mean very little to someone who has no data analysis capability to it and relies on bluff. It's not going to work as much. However, that data's got several strands of significance, and the fact that you can't communicate it doesn't mean fact that you can't communicate it is sufficient, is necessary, sufficient for someone who doesn't understand. But for someone who does understand, this is sort of this complete asymmetry. And, yeah, going forward, to answer it, because I'm very much aware of this, fundamental, problem and, how, people can cultivate students around themselves, cultures around themselves, and people around themselves. They can just systematically eliminate people who do analysis and people who are non-confrontational. They can do that. That's the significance of that, this data. So this data says this, but it's also got another significance that it means that in your hands you're going to behave this way. It's like this beautiful, much higher level significance. Now, what is it? Voltaire said, I am very fond of the truth, but I'm not so fond of martyrdom. And he also said something else, which is, he who can make you believe in the absurd can also make you do atrocities. That is, that if you do not give people the breadth, dignity and width to actually state a case, prove a case, put it through in a non-confrontational thing, the result of that, of not doing that, is in an extent an atrocity. And I sort of am getting a real view as to what is the social impact, the terror impact of atrocity. And I do think that we go back to our very ancient past, and when there wasn't words, there wasn't necessarily words, there wasn't necessarily space, there was just rumbles in the bush and people attacking you. You know, the Iron Age, absolute terror. I think people have put forward that the Iron Age is pretty much Game of Thrones land, and a good 25% of all people from these digs and stuff like that, all that remains is that 25% of people died at the hands of other people. So you had these fantastic things that we're picking up through archaeology, that we're seeing for the first time individuals surviving way beyond their use-by date. There's a evidence that there is society protecting people, but then there's also massive evidence of, become a skeleton, what happened here? Oh, he had a club in the back of the head. So this is something which does not pick up on the Neanderthal digs or anything else. This is human digs. And when you come to think of it, this propensity for violence leads to dispersal, renovation, rebuilding again. And this is sort of like one of the things that this violence does is engender a landscape of failure where the resources are dispersed, still used, and it requires the next person to come along and rebuild. And so this is one of the, I suppose, thoughts I do have, that when you do have a resource-thin area, you know, sorry, I'm just hearing it there. It's not snake weather at the moment. So, fair dinkum, if it was middle of summer, you would stop. Oh, hopefully 100 metres and listen, and you will hear this, hear snakes going along. Yeah, So this is my theory that this very, very high failure rate creates opportunities for people who don't, who are innovating for the first time, to rebuild a cart, to rebuild stone upon stone, because it's been smashed down. And and for people to come in while they've got those back turns and quietly build a social fence around them. That is, so you can imagine, although the herders used to stand up there and control the herd, this is one of the sort of the outcomes of such destructiveness. And so we have new things happening here in our modern age. One is we have computers, we have optical fiber communications, we've got things structured as never seen before. We have people who are basically sacrificed, but then we've got doctors and medical teams performing the impossible and restructuring people that should, in Iron Age terms, be dead or be in a glacier, be picked up many years, 5,000 years later, or 3,000 years later. So we've got these things which shouldn't happen. And we've got the ability now to firstly deploy the maths for the first time, that is, to have computers, to do your own student study, to actually have practice on a few things either side of the actual situation. You have the ability for the person involved, to use a Keithley spectrometer and learn something that is not possible to learn through social interaction. You learn things through social interaction, but there's a lot of overhead with it. So this is this overall conflict, and is there a way to plot your way forward? And I think it's not a grand strategy. So in terms of a chessboard, it's not opening up your bishops and queens to threaten pieces which you can't take, because once you take them, you've got nothing to back up doing it. But you can take small, basic maneuvering steps forward. Now, one is looking forward. One is to understand that a lot of information isn't flowing, and or not opportunities aren't happening because of this weird weird thought. But rather than actually going into the psychology of what's not happening, saying, well, what is the best move when it's not happening? And so this is trying to actually just move the pieces a little bit forward and possibly back again, but it would seem a small step. And this is sort of like slow control or restructuring the situation. And this is, I can't quite describe it. So although you're in a failure zone, you don't necessarily have to behave in a failure scenario. So for me, I'm in a failure zone. I don't have access to the ability to perform teaching training to get me back onto the track. So in the meantime, I'm going to go bush and see if I can actually develop the sort of on two levels, the software structure to podcast, and I'm a little while off, I'm not possibly 2 or 3 days off the Multiple Choice podcast, and then I'll again so many months off consistently be able to do YouTube tutorials and also to give other structured advice. That's because the barrier of actually getting back, that's cut off, but it's still moving forward. And so this is something that you wouldn't expect someone who is consistent. It's one of the important things is that you behave consistently with the mental framework that's put up, and one of the aspects of it is to deny people information. So if they're not sufficiently well trained or sufficiently resourced and you catch them early enough, you can switch them off, and in your sort of Iron Age burn the village type of view to get things, you can actually effectively torch the village and move on, and I won't hold certain ceremony, make sure that's will stop. So back again, I just had a big turnaround. This is beautiful, what I can say, beautiful bridge. Like, there's, look, I'd be the only person here in the whole night walking over it, and it's this beautiful stone railway bridge. It's sort of like this, in Europe you have it everywhere, it's sort of viaduct, beautiful old bridge high up. There's, what we're talking about is failure and the modes of failure and what's next. Now, for me, I suppose it's been these phases. That is, from sort of being really knocked down to that really sort of second base stage of just being able to walk and breathe and do various things. And for in that stage, it was the mental that the failure options have been set up, and I have to be strong, I have to overcome, I have to push myself against all odds, because I've got to get to the base camp and settle down and actually survey the situation. Then the next phase is sort of like a finger in the air. I'll just explore these avenues and set things up, and this will get me to a new point with these advantages, but they're going to be assets in the bag, so to speak, but they won't have any deployable effect. So this would be, I suppose, significantly the podcasting engine, and to go there is this blind effort, and if you look at any one step from the outside, the first week, 2 weeks, where I was just fumbling around with the mobile phone, finding out how to convert the mobile phone to MP3 and mechanically pushing it through, and then week after week adding things, and each time you added something, it would have almost no value. The value, of course, is when it's all put together at this final point. So at this point in time, yeah, that's going reasonably well. But it's setting something out which is outside the conceptual boundaries or this conceptual framework of the of my obstacle to get through, but it's still there, and but it's consistent with the knowledge set up outside the paradigm, that is extracting the maximum quantity of information or maximum value possible, or not feasible, practicable out. And so that means small steps like, say, the dictaphone, stuff like that, but it also means linking it up to this new generation of app. I'll just stop for a brief while to actually say how this app came to be. So this app basically is like an IP address for an idea. And so when the ideas are just dumped in the database, it reads the IP address and constructs basically a crystal of knowledge. And when I say it's a crystal, it has a nearest neighbor interaction, a dimensionality that exists in your mobile phone, which allows you to tap through. And at the moment, I've got 433. This is not like, oh, I've got 433. Oh, that's a big number. You wouldn't know that. I've got 433 app buttons. That's about 200 podcasts, with the actual podcast in MP4 and MP3, and where I can be bothered, a multiple choice and a word search linked onto it. And so some of them have four, goodly number, say about 50 have got four on it, so that's 200. There's probably about 30 node points, and the rest are just podcast after podcast going forward. And that's got a structure which I'll bring forward now. That's brought back from a number of years, because what would happen is that I would try to move forward, try to innovate in my work environment. For everything I tried to do, people would find objections. You can't do that, you can't do that. And I would just say, oh, well, that's just exploring, we can't do it. And then I'd write that down, and then I'd say, we might be able to innovate around that way. And then soon came out that I began to explore this. This is an interesting thing, that no matter what innovation I bring up, these people can actually produce objections to it and actually close everything down. And I didn't actually take this on, but I began to write this out. And then I began to write it out long-handed, complicated. So I wrote it out to something called NATO style. It's the way NATO orders standard. But this is steps and stairs stuff. The way the legislation and contracts are written, very much like the way orders are written. And there's sub-clause to go across. And as I wrote it, I recognised that the code in front of it was indeed very similar to a quantum mechanical symmetry number. And then I wrote that out as a standardised number, which can be manipulated and put into a Cartesian space, which is your mobile phone. And then it has all these properties of reveal and overlap and auditing and translation and mobile phone and basic conversation style to get to a piece of information. You can see the orientation of a piece of information. And that's through, and I was able to produce it. Now, sort of to cap it off, I was at a meeting where this person was going, the future is apps, blah, blah, blah. And as I was listening to what they were writing down, and I live was generating an app of what they said as they spoke. And at the end of it, I said, oh, would you like to see this? Oh, no. And so, in a certain sense, it explored math space, but it also explored social space. And I just generally presented it. But this is sitting there, basically an engine ready to take up high level production. And so high level production is really spewing out and sort of just falling out like a volcano into the sea. In the feeds, you can pick it up as it goes along. These apps are more sophisticated. You can actually pick and store the information. It's all filed up there. Now, you know, that's an example of the general, if you like, flanking maneuver. That is, there's a barrier here and it's just slowly flanking out to the side. Now, bear in mind of it, there's moving in that thing is there's sort of like two or three aspects which are good here. Just looking here, oh, there's stumps. It could be kangaroos. Let's have a look now. This is the sort of area that you expect a few kangaroos to be grazing on. Yeah. So that's really sort of says that the sort of two levels of the philosophy of extracting the maximum amount of information out of area, structuring the information, and living inside the information. Whereas I think people, so that's really a culturally different aspect from people who create a social handle for the information and put it away. I know someone who knows how to do that. That's irrelevant. And so rather than actually getting in, swimming around the information and being able to call it in. So like the podcasts are put out at high speed, put it out there and actually building a structure. And so we're not far off, me being able to ask a question, give one answer, two answers, three answers, four answers, and then that people to this podcast and be restructured into a multiple choice program with bells and whistles. And, you know, it's that's not far off. Now, the way of getting through that is low information. I can't do it, but I'm going to have a go at looking at it anyway. So looking at that thing, I've had my lab view, which can only display graphs in terms of waves, the wave file. And so I've pulled it out and minimized and put it across. And today I've had a little practice about listening to the actual lab view program and realizing that so when I get LabVIEW to play 10 seconds of something, I can get the mouse to track on that 10 seconds, go up and down the waveform, but I can't stop it. I can't stop it at 5 seconds. It has to play all the way through because it's there and there's no way to actually get inside the code, which the C++ code, which is buried. Eventually everything's graphical, but eventually when it's just too hard, it's just a little block with ones and noughts and terminals inside it. This is sort of like a code interface, which says the end of LabVIEW, so you can't actually get in to stop it. And so that's one case where you're dancing between the boundary of two knowledge groups, and you don't have the ultimate knowledge. So I don't have the ultimate knowledge to re-engineer Audacity to do exactly what I want. Oh gee, here comes a car. It's going to be a big walk. Sorry if I'm going to lose a bit of breath coming up. But in general, this overall strategy of sitting in the knowledge at two camps and just sitting there and appreciating the two camps. This is the, the wave function versus MP3 VLC software. Given that we know there's a third better way of doing it, is very much the same sort of philosophy of sitting amongst the open information camps. camp, that is where the information is open, and we're not for the answer, we're for the maximum processing structure. There's like, there's two sort of things, sort of like there's probably three aspects to information in general. But, you know, one is the traditional win or lose impact thing. There's also the ability to extract the maximum amount of information from, oh, here comes the cars. It must be going midnight. People are coming back from their parties or something like that. Okay, I'm going up the Mitchell's Pass. Oh, jeebies. So it was downhill for a while. Now it's going to be uphill for a bloody long while. Being able to stand between two knowledge groups and just be humble, they observe, witness, understand, which is not from evaluation or a social interaction. It's very interesting that ultimately, as a research scientist, you're ultimately alone. There's all this, many a night you're in the laser lab and it's just you and the lasers. Open the door and the lights are out. You might see a cleaner there, and it just requires hour after hour with no social interaction, just clicking away. And eventually when you get to speak to someone, you can't get a sentence together because they haven't spoken for so long. But it's not social, you're just sitting in the information. And so basically I've set up camp in these MP3 wave files. I'll sit there and I'm sort of half the way through. I'm probably another day away from getting it to where I want to. That's where it can actually just jump around an MP3 file and then slice and dice it, ready to be reconstructed as a multiple choice thing to come through. But that general presence is what I think will eventually be our strategy to move out of here. That is to sit in residence and try and understand and communicate and speak to the people who want a social outcome, don't want progress within the definition of what they think, and look at quite objectively, out questioning why, saying, well, you know, whatever the reason is, this information can't flow. Can we look at different ways of moving the information forward? Of course, at the end of the day, that's actually the prime reason it's done, to prevent the information going forward, forget the progress. But that's really unknown to them, because they're not operating at that higher level. So they really don't understand why it's so important what they're doing. They really don't understand what they're doing. And there's this sort of naive approach that you can do. So it's not celebrating failure. I sort of had a wry laugh a couple of months ago about how the irony of embracing failure was the key to actually moving through a situation where you were only left failure as an option, sort of to embrace it, get to know it, and maneuver it. Now, that being said, there's a whole series of things where I'm yet to get a full understanding. So there's these areas where I've worked on. So essentially, one result of heart operations is it can really stuff your brain. And I put my hand up to the stuffed brain. I thought these are bloody powerful long-term acting drugs. No, it's not. So the in the failure regime, my brain's had heaps of brain failures, and bit by bit I'm working back and getting the audio thought processes happening. I'm every day sitting down and writing out two full A4 pages in the clearest cursive I can muster. Not pushing myself, just getting clear, accurate writing across. So I'm just slowly building up. But that doesn't mean that I haven't got everything locked off. So these two tracks come. So there's the actual physical and mental rehabilitation, and then there's the actual sort of gentle sort of comprehension of the social situation, the fact that as I'm having to get back on my horse and learn cognitive and mathematical skills, I still will probably have to learn and master social skills, the necessary thing to go across. And so that's one level, but then on the other level, to actually maneuver a situation forward, because quite frankly the way forward is trashing the country. Like our method of science teaching has gone from 21,000 to doubling the population and getting 7,000. So in effect, we would expect to have 41,000 students studying PhD. So it's studying HC physics. We've got a fifth of the number, and out of that fifth number, very few of those are actually going on to engineering. Majority of those people are going on to be doctors and actuaries. So the actual percentage of people going into physics is an unmeted disaster. Furthermore, our ability, that the level that we're teaching through them, is going systematically down. And so sort of like a general scout, when your battalions have been absolutely minced up and you're sent out on a scout patrol to find a way out. And that's essentially what can be done. And this is a, sort of another aspect of it. So you've got those that level of basic rehab, which is open and professional. Like I'm waiting for results back to inform what's the best I should do. But and things cross. Then there's the local strategic rehab, about what, or not rehab, in what direction do you want to go, given that things are blocked, and that, you know, how do we negotiate that? And I think I can get that through. But there's another third level, which has been in an operational sense, being in charge of research groups. So your objective is to get far enough ahead and around at a unique angle to produce value for the company, value for the country. Also in the military sense, that you've got the main section. You'll be put in command of a unit, you know, a section of, generally it should be seven, but it's usually three or four people, and got out to research and find out a way out, a different way forward. Now, conceptually, this is a very valuable sort of life experience to bring in, that when you're in a corner and there is no way out, the basic training to keep calm and not attract fire to your positions, and just go out and research ways forward is there. So it's sort of a funny thing in terms of that analyze that it is failure, acknowledge the actual structuring and information coming in, which is interpreted as failure that you should be up against, and absorbing it, not returning fire, and building across. So building the set of lessons you have across to the largest frontage you can, and it may not reach ignition, but you've set it up, the communication structures, the capacities, and to see where we can actually push it up. I'm making my way up this path, which is this path, the actual very first, well, the myth is that the very first people crossed the Blue Mountains, going up this very, very, very valley. And it's interesting in that, it's trying to work out, I've got some tracksuit pants on, they're falling down. And I'm still regretting the rugging up that I've got. And this is a sort of another example. So there's that, to recognize that, but not to sort of sell it there, but to have that as a room, the sort of where your productive heart is. So the mentality is of an operations unit, a scout unit, to get up. Now, on this point of failure, I'm going to still keep on talking, is that a lot of this failure culture is really strongly built in to Australian culture. So if you get it, the convicts were society's failures, and the people who initially employed them on the moral grounds that they were benefiting from society's, they're helping society teach these convicts a lesson, that they failed. And this failure cringe culture is really still here. So a lot of the narratives, like this very walk I'm doing at the moment, is built around failure. And to understand it, a lot of the pathology that you see here now came with the First Fleet. So the First Fleet set out from England in 1788 on 11 ships, probably more, probably 13. There were 9 convict ships. There was a few military ships, and they were basically, rented ships for the task, and they'd go off for further, dump the convicts, go off and further further duties. So what happened is, I think 13 or 11 ships came in, basically 11 or 9 ships went out, never to return, and that they would go off and have lives and do other things. The important thing is that there was sort of a mix, a little bit of enlightenment going on. That is, that you should question the system, that we should reorganize things, and to a certain extent, some enterprise did take place. But the overall thing is that the culture of failure was very much brought in by someone who was schooled and lived the culture of failure, which was Captain Ross. From what is the name? Roger Ross? No, can't be. There were these whole series of shallow people, MacArthur, Johnson, and a whole group of people who were bullied. Oh, look, I'll finish this soon because this, I didn't realize how long I've been walking for. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.